For those of you who have been for the last few weeks, you may remember we are in the middle, or towards the beginning actually, of a study on the book of Nehemiah. And at this point, you would probably expect a reading from Nehemiah. However, we have reached Nehemiah chapter 3. And for those of you who know the book, you'll know it's not an easy chapter to read. So it's not going to be read. But it will be explained. I don't know about you, but I really enjoy reading novels. Normally, the easy reads that you take on holiday or something like that, because it's a bit of escapism, isn't it? You're able to get involved in someone else's story, someone else's life, and take away from what's going on in your own life. But I also have a problem with reading. Not that I can't read, but I have a problem with some of the passages in the books. I'm fine when there's the big picture and it's all fun and there's things happening and it's easy to read. But then we get to these descriptive passages that people feel they need to put in. You know, either describing the scenery or describing someone's life in detail or describing what they can see out the window. And you know, at this point, I have to say I get a bit fed up. And I start to kind of flick through to the last chapter, and sometimes the last page, just to see if this book is going to hold my interest past this detailed description. And every time I start a book, I do the same thing. I start with earnest and think, I'm going to read the whole thing, devour each page, and then I hit a sticky, tricky, descriptive passage, and I turn to the back and think, will this book satisfy me? And today, having so far followed Nehemiah on his journey through the first two chapters of the book, from Babylon, where he heard about the plight of Jerusalem, across the Empire of Persia on his journey back to his homeland, through the saga of surveying the walls in darkness to see the work that had to be done, to eventually the starting of the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem, we finally reach one of those passages which I really struggle to engage with. One of those passages which is packed full of detail. In fact, it's a passage so full of detail that it could possibly help you fall asleep at night if you were struggling. Which is one of the reasons I didn't read it this morning, because I thought, you know, that's a loser already. Because you see, basically, here in Nehemiah chapter 3, we reach the point where we're given a detailed description of the rebuilding of the whole wall of Jerusalem. Up to this point, we've had a broad sweep of the story, but now we're into detail. And it's really no surprise, because after all, this is what the book of Nehemiah is all about, the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. But what is surprising is the amount of detail that we get in this chapter. For a start, as you might be able to see, there are over 40 different sections of wall that are described in the chapter. And one of the most prominent features of the wall are the many gates that are detailed. For example, there is the sheep gate, the fish gate, the old gate, the valley gate, the dung gate, the fountain gate, the water gate, the horse gate, the east gate, the muster gate, to name but a few, all of which Nehemiah describes in some detail. And then there are the countless towers, which are dotted around the walls. The Tower of the Hundred, the Tower of Hananah, the Tower of the Ovens, the great projecting towers, all three of them. Not to mention the landmarks that Nehemiah describes as he talks of the reconstruction. Among them, Jediah's house, the priest's house, the Davidic tombs, the artificial pool, and Zadok's house, all of which are included in this great descriptive chapter, as well as a list of each person or group of people that repairs each section of the wall, describing in some cases how they repaired it, and in others, what methods they used to repair it. For instance, every time someone builds a gate in this chapter, we hear the same phrase. They laid its beams and put its doors with their bolts and bars in place. Until in the end, we basically have a whole list of repairs and repairers written down one after the other after the other, with the connecting phrase, and incidentally the most repeated phrase in the passage, and next to him, and next to them, and next to him, and next to them. Until at the end, we have one big list which makes up the whole chapter. 32 verses of detailed description. Details, details, details about how the walls of Jerusalem were finally rebuilt. And you know, if you're a details person, you might find these chapters right up your street. But for the rest of us, chapters like this in the Bible are often things we wade through to get to the next part of the story. Or we miss them out altogether, think they've got nothing to do with us, and move on. And yet, if we have the time and the perseverance to read this chapter and to take it in, which I recommend you do when you get home, if you have a chance, we'll find two things which stand out. Firstly, this chapter highlights the great skills of organisation that Nehemiah brought. I mean, here was a man with little experience of construction, as far as we're aware. Here was a man with almost no experience of leadership. Here was a man with very few followers. And here he is, within a week or so of returning to Jerusalem and surveying its walls, not only gathering people around himself, but also organising, equipping and motivating them to get on board and become involved. So much so that the 40 sections of wall were well underway before many people could catch breath and think about what was happening. This chapter is a great feat of organisation, if nothing else. However, if we look closer still and somehow manage to get past the list that's in the chapter, the geography that's described, and the incredible detail, the second thing we'll find, and perhaps the most important thing, is how clearly this chapter shows what it is to be the people of God united behind one purpose. Because you see, when Nehemiah arrived in Jerusalem, the truth is he brought with him many vital resources to complete the task. For instance, he brought the supplies needed to repair and rebuild the walls. He brought the excitement needed to get the people going. He brought the faith needed that this amazing thing could happen. And as we've said, he brought the organisation to make the task possible. He brought with him a lot of useful resources, but for the task to be completed, for the walls to be rebuilt, for the people of God to establish themselves as the people of God in Jerusalem, Nehemiah needed more than this. He needed more than simple resources. He needed people. He needed people who were willing to get involved. And this is what makes this chapter so amazing, because this is what we have. Right here in this detailed, sometimes boggy passage, we have a picture of the people Nehemiah gathered to complete his task. And it's an amazing collection when you look through. We have men, we have women, we have families, we have priests, we have Levites, we have skilled workers, we have rulers, we have single people, we have groups of people, we have sons, we have daughters, we have clans, we have the religious, we have the non-religious. And most importantly, we start off with the high priest himself getting his hands dirty. All these different people coming together to help rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And you know, the amazing thing is that before Nehemiah arrived, most of these people didn't even hang out with each other. It's not like they were all buddy-buddy all the time. They didn't share the same interests. They didn't even agree with each other, some of them. Many of them were from different political backgrounds. Most of them were from different cultural and social backgrounds. And a few of them even resented the fact that Nehemiah had taken it upon himself to organise this venture. Some of them later fell out with him, never to be reconciled. But in this chapter, at this time, for this task, they came together, each and every one of them, putting aside their pride, putting aside their personal ambition, putting aside their own expectations, putting aside other aspects of their life, to come together and sacrifice their time to get involved with what God wanted them to do. And you know, it's not many times in life that we see this, is it? In fact, I was sitting there at my desk thinking, I really need an illustration to make this point what it should be. And I couldn't think of anything, because life is hardly ever like this. I mean, yes, we often have people of certain skills and people of certain ages and people of certain areas and people of certain interests coming together now and again. But such a wide selection of people involved to such an extent. It's only really reserved for special occasions or disasters. And yet if we take this to its conclusion, this picture that's painted in Nehemiah chapter 3 is ultimately a picture of what it is to be God's people. The people of God, living out what God wants them to be. Not just in Nehemiah's time, but right here, right now, today. The people of God involved to such an extent that they're totally united in their service to him. And we might say, well, that's okay, because that's what the church is like. I mean, look around. We have men, we have women, we have families, we have single people, we have skilled workers, we have leaders, we have sons, we have daughters, we have people who love religion and people who don't love religion so much. We have all sorts of people coming together every week to be the church of God today, just like in Nehemiah's time. Well, that's true, I guess, and it's good. But I wonder, is the church of God today just like Nehemiah's time? I mean, take away what was happening in the day and the things that aren't similar. Is the church today just like this chapter that we're looking at? Do you know, I was watching Andy Murray on telly before I came out. Don't know what's happened. Don't tell me. Oh. I was watching, and it reminded me of the 2008 Wimbledon final, not because Andy Murray was there or any Briton, but because it was the great Federer-Nadal final. Don't know whether you watch tennis, anyone? Oh, good. Oh, I've hit a sport people watch. Don't get too excited. And at the 2008 Wimbledon final, my friends and I had gone out for a drink. We watched a bit of the final, and it wasn't that exciting to start with, so we thought, oh, well, you know, Federer's going to win, usual. Went out for a drink, and they had the game on in the pub, and we could hear it, you know, a few people watching, we were chatting away, and as the evening went on, we kept looking round, because if you don't know the match, it got more and more and more exciting. It went on and on and on until darkness was setting in, and the fifth set was going on. And eventually we all found that we'd left our drinks and a couple of our friends who weren't into tennis, and we gravitated to the television. And everyone had done the same. The whole pub was gathering, looking through the door at this little room where they had the telly. And we were completely involved in what was going on. We'd forgotten all about why we'd come out. We'd even forgotten our two poor friends who were chatting to themselves. And we were just engrossed in this game. Who was going to win? Who did we want to win? I thought I wanted Federer, but no, then I wanted Nadal. But poor old Federer, you were swinging and you were in it. You were involved. And then the final point was played. And Nadal, of course, won. Flung himself on the floor. All was excitement. And we walked away. And we sat down with our friends that we'd left behind. And we realised that even though we thought we'd been really involved, when the game finished, we'd only just been watching, and we walked away, and we carried on with what we'd been doing before. You see, the only two people really involved to the point of sacrifice in that game were Federer and Nadal, of course. There were others involved to certain extents, but at the end of the match, those of us who had been watching realised we'd simply been watching. And we went back to the other end of the pub and we sat down and we continued our drink. And you know, similarly, the sad thing I think about the church today is that although many of us think we're involved, and although many of us feel we're involved, and although many of us long to be involved, in reality, many of us are just watching. Watching the church try to be the church. So that when we leave each week, we just go back to what our lives were like before, as if we've just had a bit of an interlude, and we go back to what we're doing. We carry on in the same way. And you know, there may be reasons for this, good reasons for this. For instance, we may feel we don't have the right skills to get involved, or we don't have the confidence to get involved, or we're not in the right place with God to get involved. It may be because we feel other people around expect too much of us. Or it may simply be because we feel comfortable watching. But you know, the amazing thing about this passage in Nehemiah is that even though it's mainly describing a moment in time when all came together to complete a specific task, it also proves to be the chapter when the lives of the people of Israel were changed forever. So that whether they built a gate or repaired a wall or completed a large section, or when they simply worked on the area outside their own house, when these people got involved, when they came together as the united people of God, when they eventually stopped watching, they found that when all was said and done and packed away and the walls were finished, they couldn't just return to how they were living before, to what they were doing before, because God had irreversibly changed their lives completely. And you know, today, if we too, as the Church of God, have the courage to get involved, I'm not just talking about doing things, I'm talking about really being on board and involved. If we too, as the Church of God, have the courage to stop watching and be involved to the point where we put aside our own pride and we put aside our own personal ambition and we put aside our own expectations, and sometimes we put aside other aspects of our life, if we too, as the people of God, have the courage to get involved, whether it be to build the wall in front of our own house, or to join with others and attempt a bigger section, whether it be to do something tiny or attempt something large, then I'm convinced when all is said and done, not only will we be able to look and see the wonderful things that God has built here at CBC, but we'll also be able to look at our own lives and realise that they too have been changed forever. Let's just take a moment to pause and think about what God has said.